I live in a small town or a village, I'll have to take a day off from work, travel somewhere for a long time to even see a mental health professional. Right? Now, part of what happens there is you're not only losing livelihood, you may lose a job, you may not be able to find a job, you may not be able to complete education, you may not even be able to access ration card and other basic things because of a mental illness. Look at what a mental health add-on will do to increase your efficacy in your work in education or even in livelihoods, because the linkages there are so strong that we don't actually need people to do only pure play mental health. It's probably better for the ecosystem that more and more people take and tack on mental health to their existing work, because it definitely makes their existing work stronger.
Hello and welcome to a very special podcast series, Unusual Suspects. This is a series about unraveling stories of entrepreneurs, investors and businesses and professionals, and of course, philanthropists who are disruptors yet not in your face. Their disruptions have consistently delivered on the purpose and the mission they've embarked on. Their values are as strong as their mission. Unusual Suspects streams on Earshot Audience, Spotify.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, MoneyControl.com, and a host of other podcast streaming platforms. In this special episode, Catalyzing Change, the Power of Family Philanthropy, as part of Unusual Suspects, in collaboration with GivingPi, India's first family-focused philanthropy network, we are talking about the rapidly evolving philanthropic landscape and the paradigm shift that is underway. Philanthropists are increasingly leveraging technology, engaging in collaborative efforts, exploring innovative financial models, and placing a very strong emphasis on equity and inclusion in their giving strategies. Together with families and philanthropists, we explore diverse giving approaches and evolving perspectives, aiming to inspire a new era of impactful philanthropy, especially in critical and underserved sectors. In this episode, we delve into the imperative of philanthropy, particularly family philanthropy, to broaden its horizon and invest more intentionally in the mental health space in India. I'm delighted to have Raj Mariwala, Director of Mariwala Health Initiative, MHI, an advocacy capacity building and grant making organization focusing on accessible mental health for marginalized communities. Raj is also a board member of the National Center for Promotion of Employment for Disabled People, NCPEDP, and a practicing canine and feline behaviorist. Raj, delighted to have you here. Welcome to Unusual Suspects.
Thank you so much, Gaurav. Happy to be here.
Raj, let me start off with a very basic question. You know, in addition to a severe shortage of mental health professionals, India grapples with a scarcity of infrastructure, sub-service quality, inadequate awareness, a lack of research to build and scale programs, and limited funding, all of which significantly contribute to the country's burgeoning mental health crisis. Despite some increased attention during the pandemic, mental health remains stigmatized, largely inaccessible, and in dire need of substantial investment from the philanthropic community in India. How do we deal with this, Raj?
That is a very important question, and I'm really going to try to do justice to it. One thing is that India is not an outlier in this sense, because even globally, the shortage of mental health professionals exists everywhere. It exists also in the US, which has more psychiatrists than the rest of the world put together, right? The UK, which has as many psychiatrists as India does, but of course their population is much smaller than ours, they also have a shortage. So one thing is, you know, the shortage is not going to go away anytime soon. So what are the sorts of innovative things that we can look at? And not just innovative, but particularly more applicable to our context. So India has public health, but mental health so far has not reached primary health centers, is not present in villages. And one of the keys is to train more people, not just psychiatrists or clinical psychologists, to provide certain basic levels of mental health support, as long as linkages remain then to psychiatrists for those who need them. The second thing is that in India, mental health is very much a development issue. If I live in a small town or a village, I'll have to take a day off, from work, travel somewhere for a long time to even see a mental health professional. Right? Now, part of what happens there is you're not only losing livelihood, you may lose a job, you may not be able to find a job, you may not be able to complete education, you may not even be able to access ration card and other basic things because of a mental illness. So that's the second critical thing for India, which is to look at how do we provide all the social protections and social services, because those are very important for mental health. And just to give you an example, there is a linkage between unemployment and mental health. And the likelihood of developing mental health issues is about 7 times higher if you are unemployed. So I think there are multiple ways to do it. And I think if I have to give one example, it would be the government has a budget for mental health. The government budget is small, as is all global government mental health budgets. But where even the small budget goes is very important. Currently, it just goes to two very big tertiary institutions, and this needs to change. Now, this all of this blueprint is present in our law. We just need our lawmakers to implement it. So that's my one tangible output that can happen over the next 2 to 3 years that would be very important.
Raj, could you share more about how your giving journey started? How and why did you decide to focus your giving in the mental health space, Raj?
Yes, Gaurav. So, you know, about 7 to 8 years ago, my father asked for my opinion on where he should donate. And he was very clear that for him, philanthropy was not just donations, not just signing checks, but also being actively involved and using his skills and his learnings to support partners. While he was passionate about health and education, I've always been passionate about mental health as a subject, and also because I'm someone themselves who lives with a mental health condition. So I know firsthand, in a sense, despite all my privileges, some of the issues that one faces in the system. And I think the third important reason that I chose mental health was that it's a very interconnected issue. Like I was telling you, it's connected to unemployment. It's also connected to homelessness. If you have a mental illness, the likelihood of you becoming homeless is much higher. It's connected to multiple other types of physical health indicators as well, not to mention maternal health, education. So really, in India, it is very much a development issue. I think that's why I was drawn to it. And we started out by looking to see what is the interesting work that is happening in India that is not being able to expand due to very simple lack of funding. And that's how I started.
That's very interesting to learn, Raj. Can you elaborate on why MHI's work focuses on mental health for marginalized communities? And why do you think it is important? What are some of the initiatives and pathways that MHI uses to work with these groups?
Yes, Gaurav. So I think the focus was always on marginalized communities because, like I was telling you, if I live in a city, if I'm able to speak English, if I have a certain amount of money, I'll be able to access some amount of mental health services. Are the, is the quality always consistent? Possibly not, but I'll still be able to access. Right. So that was a key thing. Who is not being able to access services? Now, when we talk about taking an ecosystem approach to mental health, we said that we must design for those who cannot access. If we start out by improving what people can already access, we are not going to reach the margins. Right. So there are a couple of issues. One is language itself. The preponderance of services are all in English. Right. Maybe there's a little bit in Hindi or maybe in Tamil, but very, very minimal. Again, it's all in cities. So there are a couple of things that we did. The first thing that we funded was a helpline that offers qualified psychologists, sitting there and answering calls in over 7 languages. We helped them put out ads everywhere. And trust you me, this helpline, the iCall helpline, gets calls from very small villages to big cities. Sometimes the callers don't know which district they're calling from, but they have heard of the helpline. And so they call in across a range of issues. The second and third types of work we did were all with community-based mental health. What does community-based mental health look like in urban slum communities? What does community-based mental health look like in rural farming communities? That's how we decided to design the programs. Now, can these be shifted to different locations on the basis of just being able to reach and be more contextually appropriate? Yes. And I'll tell you why. Simply because, you know, you can't take the same approach as a BP camp or an eye camp. Tomorrow, if I send a BP doctor to a village, it's likely that he puts up a tent or she puts up a tent and villagers will come and, take their BP, etc., get a checkup. Tomorrow, if I put a psychiatrist in a village, it is very unlikely that people are going to show up, and that is part of the stigma. I think the other thing is that we have to look at non-medicalized ways to deal with mental health and to tackle stressors for marginalized folks. It could be lack of a job, it could be domestic violence. So a lot of the times, people who live in their communities feel safer talking to each other. And I'll give you an example of why I say mental health is intersectional and why we chose to work on it this way. An exciting project was one that we found in a farming district in Ahmednagar, where a farming graduate, someone from a farming family, had started to work with other farming families, going door to door and raising awareness on suicide prevention and talking about how to get people help and support, but alongside that, providing all other services, how to access government schemes, how to access the market better, maybe different seeds. And he was a graduate from a farming college in that region. He got on other volunteers in farming colleges. They go door to door. They have a helpline. They have a linkage to psychiatrists. So it's very important, like I said, if we work this for marginalized communities, you can expand it. If you start off at the most privileged, your systems will have to change. So that's why we took this particular approach.
You know, Raj, philanthropy in the mental health space in India continues to be limited, as you pointed out, despite emerging interest in this domain. What have been some of the challenges that you have faced in your giving journey in this space? And importantly, how have you navigated through them, Raj?
Yes, so you are right. And again, this is, I think, mirroring what happens world over. World over, philanthropy gives less to mental health. In India, I think it's been a combination of, while there have been some persons giving small amounts, again, it's a field that is a little hard to understand. Let's just say the entry barriers can be intimidating for people to scale or to engage with. That's one. Second, I think people are used to getting data and having impact figures. Now, those are not going to look like your typical physical health figures, which unfortunately, that's what people compare them to, right? So some of the things that we did initially when reaching out to other funders was we said, come spend some time with us. We'll show you what our sheets look like. And we get that, you know, you're freaking out about the fact that the personnel costs are so high, but the output per patient or whatever is so low. So sit down with us, come to our office, we'll show you all of our data and then think about it. And, you know, trust us, we'll help you do the program if you want. We can even administer it for you. And it was really part of our mandate to get more mental health funding. And so we did that with quite a few funders. We administered some funders' donations for mental health without any fees, of course, so that they would feel more comfortable funding mental health. But I think this challenge exists, still at a pretty grave level, where people are used to seeing very different impact numbers for other types of philanthropy, but in mental health, the impacts look different and we haven't figured out a way to, I guess, quantify them as clearly as many philanthropists would like.
Raj, from your experience of working in this space for many years, can you share some learnings or big, what are called as aha moments, and how have they shaped your philanthropy and approach at MHI, Raj?
That's an interesting question. And I believe that I think the approach that we took to fund for organizations who had already been doing work in mental health, actually, that was a big aha moment for us, because we spent a lot of time and, you know, very grateful to them for each coming to us every month and sharing their learnings, helping us learn. So I think in terms of philanthropy as a whole, one aha moment is it is absolutely critical to learn from your partners, right? Because that is what enabled us then to go from four partners in 2018, and right now we're in 2024, we have about 50 partners. So that's one big aha learning. I think the second big aha learning is really there is such amazing, innovative work being done in mental health in India. And we may not have known it had we not made very concerted efforts to step out of our bubble, to look outside of organizations that speak English, that could send us an English funding proposal, right? And now we have funding proposals sometimes, you know, dictated over the phone. We help write them. So I think there is so many interesting things happening in India. And for philanthropy in particular, an aha moment is that you must look beyond your systems and who are they excluding, because you're missing out on a range of exciting work going on. I think in terms of mental health, the third aha moment for me personally was the power of community. And looking at a lot of our community-based mental health work, since we have community-based mental health champions who are so much closer to the ground, who have a so much better grasp of what is going on in their communities, what the stressors are, and who is suffering, I think that is a very, very powerful approach to use. And in my opinion, actually, even Western and high-income countries would do well to learn from this approach. Thanks, Gaurav.
You know, Raj, there's growing interest in the mental health space now, comparatively, compared to, say, a couple of years ago, with more philanthropists backing upcoming initiatives like you and showing an interest in wanting to give in this domain. In your experience, what are the opportunities or needs within the broad domain of mental health where philanthropists can focus on? Also, what advice would you share with those wanting to begin giving to mental health, Raj?
This is probably my favorite question. So, in terms of the domains, I think, you know, it is still pretty much a blank slate. There is just so much to be done in the area of services, in the area of advocacy. If we take geographies, one thing to do, I think, is very important, which, again, we've been trying to do, is how do we support services and initiatives in communities that interlock with government services, right? So it provides a demand for government services. Government is then accountable to provide the services, which is in the letter of our law. And of course, then you get, you know, that elusive scale that so many philanthropists like. So I think there's that. If I drill down a bit deeper, there are some very important areas in India. Youth mental health is, of course, one. And as years go by, we will find that senior people's mental health, geriatric mental health in technical terms, is also going to be important. Maternal mental health is a big one. Essentially, I think every point of mental health, which is psychosocial, that is, that it is very linked to our context. I'm not going to go into particular diseases, which is usually how it's done. People may say Alzheimer's, people may say bipolar disorder. And while it is very important to look at severe mental illness, and you know there is pathways to look at it, for newer funders, I would suggest starting out with mental health stressors, taking a development-based approach to mental health, and really moving and learning from partners there to then help provide support to certain topics. It could be schizophrenia, it could be bipolar disorder. And honestly, that's exactly what we did as well. And that brings me, I think, to my second piece of advice, which is it is absolutely critical for any funder to look at, give importance to, and really center voices of lived experience, those who have lived with or are living with mental health conditions. I think one of the grave errors that one tends to make is to only to talk to the experts. And one cannot really do that in mental health simply because it's a rights issue. Mental health is a rights issue. And if we want to improve quality, we will have to talk to those with lived experience. And it's kind of odd. And, you know, I'm going to say it on this podcast because you interview a range of people. But when a product is taken to market, there's always consumer research done. So why would we use a different standard for this? Why are we going only to the experts, right? So we've done something very similar at MHI. We tend to look for only voices of lived experience. A lot of our projects that we fund are led by people with lived experience, that is either of mental health conditions or those who come from the community that they are serving, right? So I think that is the one most critical thing to do. Do not go to only psychiatrists. And I think finally, I would say, talk to other funders if you are uncertain about impact and numbers. There's no harm in starting off small. But I think to start off is very important. And finally, this is something that I've been saying to a lot of funders. If you don't want to fund mental health, pure play mental health, that is fine. But if you are someone who works in HIV/AIDS medication and HIV/AIDS physical health work, look at what a mental health tack-on intervention will do to increase your efficacy. Look at what a mental health tack-on will do to increase your efficacy in maternal mental health. Look at what a mental health add-on will do to increase your efficacy in your work in education or even in livelihoods, because the linkages there are so strong that we don't actually need people to do only pure play mental health. It's probably better for the ecosystem that more and more people take and tack on mental health to their existing work, because it definitely makes their existing work stronger.
Raj, finally, as India approaches its 100th year of independence, considering the critical role of philanthropy in India's social development, what, according to you, can philanthropy do differently to invest intentionally in the mental health space? What are some innovative pathways or strategies that givers can embrace, particularly families, to build an India where no one is left behind? Raj?
Yes. So I think the innovative strategy is, look, this is money that you are devoting for philanthropy. Try not to look at impact numbers. Try not to look at data. Think about it as depth. We will never reach scale if we don't think about inclusion. Now, why does philanthropy exist? It exists because there are inequalities, and ideally your money should go to reducing these inequalities. Now, mental health can be a great leveler of inequalities if supported well. So one must actually change their whole approach to philanthropy. Rather than looking at what is easier to fund, rather than looking at funding in the states that y'all are from, it's very important to have a vibrant mental health ecosystem. And I would say that this is, I think, across any kind of giving issue, that one must really look at, stop looking at so much of qualitative data around impact. Go to the communities, ask them impact. What is the depth of your impact? How are you going to be intersectoral in your giving? One of my favorite feminist authors said that we don't live single issue lives, and that's very much true. COVID showed us that. Climate change with disasters, we are also seeing the linkages of mental health and climate change. And unless we learn to do things better, and that includes all our systems, which is definitely philanthropy, we are not going to be able to make a dent. I would say in terms of more mental health specific advice, community-based mental health is the best innovation. Already abroad and in quite a few Western countries, people are trying to adopt an innovation, a community-based mental health innovation that came out of Africa called the Friendship Bench, where grandmothers sit on benches to talk to young people. Now, I think it's time that we change our systems and learn to do things better so that no one is left behind. And we can do that, keeping in mind lived experience. So again, another phrase, nothing about us without us. And finally, no one is free until all of us are free.
Absolutely, Raj. So well said and so well articulated. Thank you for sharing your deep insights and perspectives and taking the time out to drop by to have this conversation with us. Thank you, Raj.
Thanks so much, Gaurav. It was lovely chatting with you.
Thanks.